Suddenly, Ned recalled his mother's conversation with Bishop Julius in the cloisters of the ruined priory. Alice had told Julius the exact amount of the debt, and Julius had seemed momentarily struck by the figure, though in the end he had not commented. And here Julius was in court for the hearing. Ned frowned anxiously. The contract between Alice and Sir Reginald had been drawn carefully, so that there was no reference to interest. But the definition of usury was notoriously a grey area of law. Alice said firmly, "No interest was payable. The contract states that Sir Reginald will pay rent of £8 a month for the continued use of the priory until the loan is repaid or the property is forfeited." Reginald protested. "Why would I pay rent? I never use the place. This was nothing less than concealed usury." Alice said, "But you proposed it." "I was misled." The clerk interrupted. "Please, address the court, not each other." Justice Tilbury said, "Thank you, Mr. Pettit." "Quite right." Rollo said, "The court cannot enforce a contract that requires a party to commit a crime." Tilbury said, "Yes, I have grasped that point. So you're asking the court to decide whether the extra money payable under the contract is genuinely rent or a concealed form of usury?" "No, Your Worship. I am not asking you to decide. With your permission, I will bring an authoritative witness who will testify that this is usury." Ned was bewildered. What was he talking about? The two justices seemed equally puzzled. Tilbury said, "An authoritative witness. Who do you have in mind?" "The Bishop of Kingsbridge." A murmur of surprise went up from the watching crowd. No one had anticipated this. Justice Tilbury looked as startled as anyone. However, after a few moments he said, "Very well. What have you got to say, my Lord Bishop?" Ned was dismayed. Everyone knew whose side Julius was on. Julius walked slowly to the front, his bald head high, making the most of the dignity of his office. As expected, he said, "The so-called rent is clearly disguised interest. Sir Reginald did not use the land and buildings during the period in question, and had never intended so to do. This was nothing but a flimsy cover for the sin and crime of usury." Alice said, "I protest. The bishop is not an unbiased witness. Sir Reginald has promised the priory to him." Rollo said, "Surely you do not accuse the bishop of dishonesty." Alice replied, "I accuse you of asking the cat whether the mouse should be allowed to go free." The crowd laughed. They appreciated wit in argument. But Justice Tilbury did not. "This court can hardly contradict the bishop on a question of sin," he said severely. "It seems the jury will have to rule that the contract is invalid." He looked unhappy about it, for he knew as well as anyone that many contracts made by Kingsbridge traders might be undermined by such a ruling. But Rollo had backed him into a corner. "Now," Rollo said, "it is no longer a matter merely of invalidating the contract, Your Worships." The look of malicious satisfaction on his face worried Ned. Rollo went on. "Alice Willard has been proved guilty of a crime. I submit that it is the duty of the court to impose the punishment laid down in the Act of 1552. Ned did not know what punishment was specified by the law. Alice said, "I will plead guilty to usury, on one condition." Tilbury said, "All right. What?" "There is another person in this court who is as guilty as I am, and he must be punished too." "If you're referring to Sir Reginald, the crime attaches to the lender, not the borrower."
"Not Sir Reginald."
"Who, then?"
"The Bishop of Kingsbridge."
Julius looked angry. "Take care what you say, Alice Willard." Alice said,
"Last October, you pre-sold the fleeces of 1,000 sheep to Widow Mercer for 10 pence each."
Widow Mercer was the biggest wool dealer in town. "The sheep were sheared this April, and Mrs. Mercer sold the fleeces to Filbert Cobley for 12 pence each, 2 pence more than she paid you. You forfeited 2 pence per fleece in order to have your money 6 months earlier. You paid 40% annual interest." There was a mutter of approval. Most of the leading citizens were traders, and they understood percentages. Julius said, "I am not on trial here. You are." Alice ignored that.
In February, you bought stone from the Earl's quarry for the extension to your palace. The price was £3, but the Earl's quarry master offered you a reduction of a shilling in the pound for advance payment, which you accepted. The stone was delivered by barge a month later. In effect, you charged the Earl 60% interest on the money you paid early.
The crowd were beginning to enjoy this, and Ned heard laughter and a ripple of applause.
Pettit shouted, "Silence!"
Alice said,
"In April, you sold a flour mill in Wigley."
"This is irrelevant,"
Julius said.
"You cannot excuse yourself by claiming, plausibly or otherwise, that other people have committed similar crimes."
Tilbury said, "The bishop is right about that. I direct the jury to declare Alice Willard guilty of usury."
Ned harbored a faint hope that the businessmen in the jury might protest, but they did not have the nerve to challenge such a clear direction from the justices, and after a moment they all nodded agreement.
Tilbury said, "We will now consider the question of punishment."
Rollo spoke again. "The Act of 1552 is very clear, your worships. The culprit must lose both interest and principal of the loan, and in addition, fines and ransom at the king's will or pleasure," to quote the exact words of the law.
Ned shouted, "No!"
Surely his mother could not forfeit the £400 as well as the interest.
The Kingsbridge folk felt the same, and there was a mutinous hubbub. Paul Pettit had to call for silence again. The crowd eventually went quiet, but Tilbury did not immediately speak. He turned to his fellow justice, Seb Chandler, and they held a murmured conversation. Then Tilbury summoned Pettit to join them. The silence grew tense. The justices talked to Pettit, who was a qualified lawyer, as were all clerks of the peace. They appeared to be arguing, with Pettit shaking his head in negation. Finally, Tilbury shrugged and turned away. Seb Chandler nodded agreement, and Pettit returned to his seat. At last, Tilbury spoke.
"The law is the law," he said,
and Ned knew at once that his mother was ruined. "Alice Willard must forfeit both the amount of the loan and the additional rent or interest demanded." He had to raise his voice over the noise of protest.
"No further punishment will be necessary."
Ned stared at his mother. Alice was stricken. Until now she had been defiant, but she had been up against the full power of the church, and her resistance had been hopeless. Now she was suddenly diminished, dazed, pale, bewildered. She looked like one who has been knocked off her feet by a charging horse. The clerk said,
"Next case."
Ned and his mother left the court and walked down the main street to their house without speaking. Ned's life had been turned upside down, and he could hardly digest the implications. 6 months ago, he had been sure of spending his life as a merchant, and almost sure of marrying Marjorie. Now he had no employment, and Marjorie was engaged to Bart. They went into the parlour.
"At least we won't starve,"
Alice said. "We've still got the houses in St. Mark's." Ned had not expected his mother to be so pessimistic.
"Won't you find a way to start again?"
Alice shook her head wearily.
"I'll be 50 soon. I haven't got the energy. Besides, when I look back over the past year, I seem to have lost my judgment. I should have moved some of the traffic away from Calais when the war broke out last June. I should have developed the Seville connection more, and I should never have lent money to Reginald Fitzgerald, no matter how much pressure he put on me. Now there's no business left for you and your brother to inherit."
"Barney won't mind," Ned said. "He'd rather be at sea anyway."
"I wonder where he is now. We must tell him if we can locate him."
"He's probably in the Spanish army." They had received a letter from Aunt Betsy. Barney and Carlos had got in trouble with the Inquisition and had been forced to leave Seville in a hurry. Betsy was not sure where they had gone, but a neighbor thought he had seen them listening to a recruiting captain down at the dockside. Alice said glumly,
"But I don't know what you'll do, Ned. I've brought you up to be a merchant."
"Sir William Cecil said he needed a young man like me to work for him."
She brightened. "So he did. I had forgotten."
"He may have forgotten, too." Alice shook her head.
"I doubt he ever forgets anything."
Ned wondered what it might be like, working for Cecil, being part of Elizabeth Tudor's household. "I wonder if Elizabeth
will be queen one day. His mother spoke with sudden bitterness. If she is, perhaps she'll get rid of some of these arrogant bishops. Ned began to see a glimmer of hope. Alice said, I'll write to Cecil for you, if you like. I don't know, Ned said. I might simply show up on his doorstep. He might simply send you home again. Yes, said Ned. He might. The Revenge of the Fitzgeralds continued the next day. The weather was hot, but the south transept of Kingsbridge Cathedral was cool in the afternoon. All the leading citizens were there for the church court. The Protestants arrested in Widow Pollard's barn were on trial for heresy. Few people were ever found not guilty. Everyone knew that. The main question was how harsh the punishments would be. Filbert Cobley faced the most serious charges. He was not in the cathedral when Ned arrived, but Mrs. Cobley stood there weeping helplessly. Pretty Ruth Cobley was red-eyed, and Dan's round face looked uncharacteristically grim. Filbert's sister and Mrs. Cobley's brother were trying to give comfort. Bishop Julius was in charge. This was his court. He was prosecutor as well as judge, and there was no jury. Beside him sat Canon Stephen Lincoln, a young sidekick, handing him documents and making notes. Next to Stephen was the Dean of Kingsbridge, Luke Richards. Deans were independent of bishops and did not always follow their orders. Luke was the only hope for mercy today. One by one, the Protestants confessed their sins and recanted their beliefs. By doing so, they escaped physical punishment. They were given fines, which most of them paid to the bishop immediately. Dan Cobley was their deputy leader, according to Julius, and he was given an additional humiliating sentence. He had to parade through the streets of Kingsbridge wearing only a nightshirt, carrying a crucifix, and chanting the Paternoster in Latin. But Filbert was the leader, and everyone was waiting to see what his sentence would be. Suddenly the crowd's attention turned to the nave of the church. Following the direction in which they were looking, Ned saw Osmond Carter approaching in his leather helmet and laced knee boots. He was with another member of the watch, and they were carrying between them a wooden chair that had on it some kind of bundle. Looking more closely, Ned saw that the bundle was Filbert Cobley. Filbert was stocky, an imposing figure in spite of being short, or he had been. Now his legs hung loose over the edge of the chair, and his arms dangled limply at his sides. He groaned in pain constantly, his eyes closed. Ned heard Mrs. Cobley scream at the sight. The watchmen put the chair down in front of Bishop Julius and stood back. The chair had arms that prevented Filbert from falling sideways, but he could not hold himself upright, and he began to slip down in the chair. His family rushed to him. Dan took him under the arms and lifted him back. Filbert screamed in agony. Ruth pushed at Filbert's hips to keep him in a sitting position. Mrs. Cobley moaned,
Oh, Phil, my Phil, what have they done to you?
Ned realized what had happened. Filbert had been tortured on the rack. His wrists had been attached to two posts. Then his ankles had been tied with ropes that were wrapped around a geared wheel. As the gears were turned, the wheel tightened the rope, and the victim's body was stretched agonizingly. This form of torment had been devised because priests were forbidden to shed blood. Filbert had obviously resisted and refused to recant his beliefs, despite the pain. So the torture had continued until the shoulder and hip joints had been completely dislocated. He was now a helpless cripple. Bishop Julius said, Filbert Cobley has admitted to leading gullible fools into heresy. Canon Lincoln brandished a document. Here is his signed confession. Dan Cobley approached the judge's table. Show me, he said. Lincoln hesitated and looked at Julius. The court was under no obligation to the son of the accused man, but Julius probably did not want to provoke further protests from the crowd. He shrugged, and Lincoln gave the papers to Dan. Dan looked at the last page and said, This is not my father's signature. He showed it to the men nearest him. Any one of you knows my father's hand. This is not it. Several of them nodded agreement. Julius said irritably,
He was not able to sign unassisted, obviously.
Dan said,
So you stretched him until...
He choked, tears rolling down his face, but he forced himself to go on.
You stretched him until he was unable to write, and yet you pretend that he signed this.
Pretend? Are you accusing a bishop of lying?
I'm saying my father never admitted to heresy.
How could you possibly know? He did not believe himself to be a heretic, and the only reason he would have said the opposite was torture.
He was prayerfully persuaded of the error of his ways.
Dan pointed dramatically to his father's hideous form.
Is this what happens to a man when the Bishop of Kingsbridge prays for him?
The court will not hear any more of this insolence. Ned Willard spoke up. Where is the rack? The three priests looked at him in silence. Filbert has been racked, that's obvious.
But where?
Ned said.
Here in the cathedral.
In the bishop's palace?
Underneath the courthouse?
Where is the rack kept? I think the citizens of Kingsbridge are entitled to know. Torture is a crime in England, except when licensed by the Privy Council. Who has been given permission to carry out torture in Kingsbridge?
After a long pause, Stephen Lincoln said, There is no rack in Kingsbridge.
Ned digested this fact. So Filbert was tortured elsewhere. Do you imagine that makes it all right?
He pointed a finger at Bishop Julius. It doesn't matter if he was tortured in Egypt. If you sent him there, you are the torturer.
Be silent!
Ned decided he had made his point. He turned his back and stepped away. At that point, Dean Luke stood up. He was a tall, stooped man of 40 with a mild manner and thinnish, greying hair.
My Lord Bishop, I urge you to be merciful, he said.
Filbert is undoubtedly a heretic and a fool, but he is also a Christian, and in his misguided way he seeks to worship God. No man should be executed for that.
He sat down. There was a collective sound of agreement from the watching citizens. They were mostly Catholics, but they had been Protestants under the two previous monarchs, and none of them felt entirely safe. Bishop Julius gave the dean a look of withering contempt, but did not reply to his plea. He said,
Filbert Cobley is guilty, not just of heresy, but of spreading heresy. As is usual in such cases, he is sentenced to be excommunicated and then burned to death. The execution will be carried out by the secular authorities tomorrow at dawn.
There were several different methods of execution. Noblemen normally benefited from the quickest, having their heads chopped off, which was instant if the executioner was skilled, and took only a minute if he was clumsy and needed several blows with the axe before the neck was fully severed. Traitors were hung, disemboweled while still living, then hacked into pieces. Anyone who robbed the church was flayed, his skin cut off him with a very sharp knife while he was still alive. An expert could take off the skin in one piece. Heretics were burned alive. The townspeople were not completely taken by surprise, but all the same they greeted the sentence with a horrified silence. No one had yet been burned in Kingsbridge. Ned thought that a ghastly line was being crossed, and he sensed that his neighbours felt the same. Suddenly, Filbert's voice was heard, loud and surprisingly strong. He must have been saving his remaining energy for this.
I thank God that my agony has almost ended, Julius. But yours has yet to begin, you blaspheming devil.
There was a gasp of shock at this insult, and Julius leaped to his feet, outraged. But a condemned man was traditionally allowed his say.
Soon you will go to hell where you belong, Julius. And your torment will never end, and may God damn your eternal soul.
The curse of a dying man was especially potent, and though Julius would have scorned such superstition, nevertheless he was trembling with rage and fear.
Take him away, he shouted, and clear the church. This court is closed.
He turned and stormed out through the south door. Ned and his mother went home in a grim silence. The Fitzgeralds had won. They had killed the man who cheated them, They had stolen the Willards' fortune, and they had kept their daughter from marrying Ned. It was total defeat. Janet Fife served them a desultory supper of cold ham. Alice drank several glasses of sherry wine. "Will you go to Hatfield?" she asked him as Janet cleared away. "I still haven't decided. Marjorie isn't married yet. But even if Bart were to drop dead tomorrow, they still wouldn't let her marry you. She turned 16 last week. In 5 years' time, she'll be able to marry whoever she likes. But you can't stand still like a ship becalmed for so long. Don't let this blight your life." She was right, he knew. He went to bed early and lay awake. Today's dreadful proceedings made him more inclined to go to Hatfield, but still he could not make up his mind. It would be giving up hope. He drifted off to sleep in the small hours and was awakened by sounds outside. Looking out of his bedroom window, he saw men in the market square, their movements illuminated by half a dozen flaming torches. They were bringing dry sticks for the execution. Sheriff Mathewson was there, a big man wearing a sword, supervising the preparations. A priest could condemn a man to death, but could not carry out the sentence himself. Ned put on a coat over his nightshirt and went outside. The morning air smelled of wood smoke. The Cobley family were there, and most of the other Protestants arrived soon. The crowd swelled within minutes. By first light, as the torch flames seemed to fade, there were at least 1,000 people in the square in front of the cathedral. The men of the watch forced the spectators to keep their distance. The crowd was noisy, but they fell silent when Osmond Carter appeared from the direction of the Guildhall, with another watchman, the two men again carrying Filbert between them on a wooden chair. They had to force their way through the crowd, who made way reluctantly, as if they would have liked to obstruct the progress of the chair, but did not quite have the courage. The women of the Cobley family wailed piteously as the helpless man was tied upright to a wooden stake in the ground. He kept slipping down on his useless legs, and Osmond had to bind him tightly to keep him in place. The watchmen piled firewood around him while Bishop Julius intoned a prayer in Latin. Osmond picked up one of the torches that had lit their nighttime labors. He stood in front of Filbert and looked at Sheriff Mathewson, who held up a hand, indicating that Osmond should wait. Mathewson then looked at Julius. In the pause, Mrs. Cobley started screaming, and her family had to hold her. Julius nodded. Mathewson dropped his arm, and Osmond put the torch to the firewood around Filbert's legs. The dry wood caught quickly, and the flames crackled with hellish merriment. Filbert cried out feebly at the heat. Wood smoke choked the nearest watchers, who backed away. Soon there was another smell, one that was at once familiar and sickening, the smell of roasting meat. Filbert began to scream in pain. In between screams, he yelled, "Take me, Jesus! Take me, Lord! Now, please, now!" But Jesus did not take him yet. Ned had heard that merciful judges sometimes allowed the family to hang a bag of gunpowder around the neck of the condemned man, so that his end would be quick. But Julius evidently had not permitted that kindness. The lower half of Filbert's body burned, while he remained alive. The noise he made in his agony was unbearable to hear, more like the squealing of a terrified animal than the sound of a man. At last, Filbert fell silent. Perhaps his heart gave out. Perhaps the smoke suffocated him. Perhaps the heat boiled his brain. The fire continued to burn, and the dead body of Filbert turned into a blackened ruin. The smell was disgusting, but at least the noise had stopped. Ned thanked God. It was over at last. In my short life, I had never seen anything so dreadful. I did not know how men could do such things, and I did not understand why God would let them. My mother said something that I have remembered all the subsequent years. When a man is certain that he knows God's will, and is resolved to do it regardless of the cost, he is the most dangerous person in the world. When the spectators began to drift away from the marketplace, I remained. The sun rose, though it did not shine on the smouldering remains, which were in the cold shadow of the cathedral.
I was thinking about Sir William Cecil and our conversation about Elizabeth on the 12th day of Christmas. He had said, "Elizabeth has told me many times that if she should become queen, it is her dearest wish that no Englishman should lose his life for the sake of his beliefs. I think that's an ideal worthy of a man's faith." At the time it had struck me as a pious hope, but after what I had just seen, I thought again. Was it even possible that Elizabeth would get rid of dogmatic bishops such as Julius, and end scenes such as the one I had just witnessed? Might there come a time when people of different faiths did not kill one another? But would Elizabeth become queen when Mary Tudor died? That would depend, I supposed, on what kind of help she got. She had the formidable William Cecil, but one man was not enough. She needed an army of supporters, and I could be one. The prospect lifted my heart. I stared at the ashes of Filbert Cobley. I felt sure it did not have to be like this. There were people in England who wanted to stop this happening, and I wanted to be with them. I wanted to fight for Elizabeth's tolerant ideals. No more burnings. I decided to go to Hatfield. Chapter 8. Ned walked from Kingsbridge to Hatfield, a journey of 100 miles, not knowing whether he would be welcomed and given employment or sent ignominiously home. For the first 2 days, he was with a group of students going to Oxford. Everyone travelled in groups. A man on his own was in danger of being robbed. A woman on her own was more vulnerable to worse dangers. As he had been taught by his mother, Ned talked to everyone he met, acquiring information that might or might not be useful. Prices of wool, leather, iron ore and gunpowder, news of plagues and storms and floods, bankruptcies and riots, aristocratic weddings and funerals. Each night he stayed in taverns, often sharing beds, an unpleasant experience for a boy from the merchant class used to his own room. However, the students were lively companions on the road, switching from coarse jokes to theological arguments and back again effortlessly. The July weather was warm, but at least it did not rain. During pauses in the conversation, Ned worried about what awaited him at Hatfield Palace. He hoped to be greeted as just the young assistant they were looking for. But Cecil might say, "Ned who?" If he was rejected, he did not know quite what he would do next. It would be humiliating to return to Kingsbridge with his tail between his legs. Perhaps he would go to London and try his luck in the big city. In Oxford, he stayed at Kingsbridge College. Established by the great Prior Philip as an outpost of Kingsbridge Priory, it had become independent of the monastery, but it still provided accommodation for students from Kingsbridge and hospitality to Kingsbridge citizens. It was more difficult to find travelling companions for the journey from Oxford to Hatfield. Most people were going to London, which was out of Ned's way. While waiting, he fell under the spell of the university. He liked the lively discussions about all kinds of topics, from where the Garden of Eden was to how the earth could be round without people falling off it. Most students would become priests, a few lawyers or doctors. Ned's mother had told him he would learn nothing at a university that could be of use to a merchant. Now he wondered if she had been right. She was wise, but not omniscient. After 4 days, he joined a group of pilgrims going to St. Albans Cathedral. That took another 3 days. Then he took a chance and walked alone, the last 7 miles from St. Albans to his destination. King Henry VIII had confiscated Hatfield Palace from the Bishop of Ely, and had used it as an occasional nursery for his children. Elizabeth had spent much of her childhood there, Ned knew. Now Queen Mary Tudor, Elizabeth's older half-sister, liked to keep her there. Hatfield was 20 miles north of London, a day's walk or half a day's fast ride. Elizabeth was out of London, where she might have been a nuisance, but close enough to be watched. Elizabeth was not exactly a prisoner, but she was not free to come and go as she pleased. The palace was visible from a distance, atop a rise. It looked like an enormous barn built of red brick with leaded windows. As he climbed the slope to the entrance arch, Ned saw that it was in fact 4 linked buildings in a square, enclosing a courtyard big enough to hold several tennis courts. His apprehension grew as he saw the busy crowd in the yard, grooms and lawn dresses and delivery boys. He realized that even though Elizabeth was out of favor, she was still royal, and she maintained a large household. Probably lots of people would have liked to work for her. Perhaps the servants turned applicants away every day. He walked into the courtyard and looked around. Everyone was busy. No one noticed him. Cecil might be away, he realized. One reason the man needed an assistant was that he could not be at Hatfield all the time. Ned went up to an older woman, placidly shelling peas.
"Good day, mistress,"
he said politely. "Where might I find Sir William Cecil?"
"Ask the fat man,"
she said, jerking a thumb at a well-dressed, heavy-set figure Ned had not previously noticed.
"Tom Parry."
Ned approached the man. "Good day, Master Parry," he said. "I'm here to see Sir William Cecil."
"A lot of people would like to see Sir William," said Parry.
"If you tell him Ned Willard from Kingsbridge is here, he will be glad of the information."
"Will he now?"
Parry was skeptical.
"From Kingsbridge?"
"Yes. I walked here." Parry was unimpressed.
"I didn't think you'd flown.
Will you be so kind as to give him my name? And if he asks me what business Ned Willard has with him, what shall I say?" The confidential matter he and I discussed with the Earl of Shiring on the 12th day of Christmas.
"Sir William and the Earl and you," said Parry. "What were you doing?"
"Serving the wine." Ned smiled thinly.
"No.
But the topic was, as I mentioned, confidential." He decided that if he submitted himself to any further rude interrogation, he would begin to seem desperate. So he ended the conversation.
"Thank you for your courtesy," he said, and turned his back.
"All right, no need to take umbrage. Come with me."
Ned followed Parry into the house. The place was gloomy and somewhat decrepit. Elizabeth might have had a royal income, but clearly it did not stretch to refurbishing a palace. Parry opened a door, looked in, and said,
"Do you want to receive a Ned Willard from Kingsbridge, Sir William?"
A voice inside answered,
"Very well."
Parry turned to Ned.
"Go in."
The room was large, but not richly decorated. A working office with ledgers on shelves, rather than a reception room. Cecil sat at a writing table, with pens and ink, paper and sealing wax. He wore a black velvet doublet that looked too warm for summer weather. But he was sedentary, and Ned had been walking in the sun.
"Ah, yes, I remember,"
Cecil said when he saw Ned. "Alice Willard's boy." His tone was neither friendly nor unfriendly, just a little wary.
"Is your mother well?"
"She's lost all her money, Sir William," Ned replied. "Most of our fortune was in Calais.
Several good men have suffered a similar fate.
We were foolish to declare war on France.
But why have you come to me? I can't get Calais back."
"When we met, at the Earl of Shiring's banquet, you said you were looking for a young man a bit like myself, to help you in your work for the Lady Elizabeth. My mother told you I was destined to work in the family business, and therefore unavailable. But now there is no business.
I don't know whether you found someone."
"I did," said Cecil, and Ned was crestfallen. Then Cecil added, "But he turned out to be a bad choice."
Ned brightened again. "I would be honored and grateful if you would consider me for the position," he said eagerly.
"I don't know," Cecil said. "This is not one of those posts that exists to provide an income for a courtier. It requires real work.
I'm prepared to work."
"Perhaps, but to be frank, a boy from a rich background whose family have fallen on bad times does not usually make a good assistant. He's liable to be too accustomed to giving the orders himself, and he may find it strange that anyone should expect him to do what he's told promptly and conscientiously. He just wants the money."
"I want more than the money."
"You do?"
"Sir William, 2 weeks ago we burned a Protestant in Kingsbridge. Our first."
Ned knew he should not get emotional, but he could hardly help it. "As I watched him die screaming,
I remembered what you said to me about Elizabeth's wish that no one should be killed for his faith. Cecil nodded. I want her to be queen one day, Ned said passionately. I want our country to be a place where Catholics and Protestants don't kill one another. When the moment comes, I want to be with you as you help Elizabeth to win the throne. That's the real reason I'm here.
Cecil stared hard at Ned, as if trying to look into his heart and determine whether he was sincere. After a long pause, he said,
All right, I'll give you a trial.
Thank you, Ned said fervently. I promise you won't regret it.
Ned was still in love with Marjorie Fitzgerald, but he would have gone to bed with Elizabeth in a heartbeat. And yet she was not beautiful. She had a big nose and a small chin, and her eyes were too close together. But, paradoxically, she was irresistibly alluring, astonishingly clever, as charming as a kitten, and shamelessly flirtatious. The effect was hardly reduced by her imperiousness and her occasional bad temper. Men and women adored her even after she had scolded them cruelly. Ned had never met anyone remotely like her. She was overpowering. She spoke French to him, mocked his hesitant Latin, and was disappointed that he could not help her practice her Spanish. She let him read any of her books that he fancied, on condition he discussed them with her. She asked him questions about her finances that made it clear she understood accounts as well as he did. Within a few days he learned the answers to two key questions. First, Elizabeth was not plotting against Queen Mary Tudor. In fact, she expressed a horror of treason that seemed genuine to Ned. However, she was preparing, quite methodically, to make a bid for the throne after Mary's death, whenever that might be. Cecil's Christmas trip to Kingsbridge had been part of a program in which he, and other allies of Elizabeth, visited the most important cities in England to assess her support and opposition. Ned's admiration for Cecil grew fast. The man thought strategically, judging every issue by its long-term effect on the destiny of the princess he served. Second, Elizabeth was a Protestant, despite Cecil's pretense that she had no strong religious convictions. She went to Mass and performed every Catholic ritual that was expected of her, but that was for show. Her favorite book was Paraphrases of the New Testament by Erasmus. Most telling was her bad language. She used swear words that Catholics considered offensive. In polite company, she chose phrases that were not quite blasphemous. Blood instead of God's blood, zounds for God's wounds, and Mary for Mary. But in private she was more profane, saying by the Mass, and, her favorite, God's body. In the mornings she studied with her tutor, and Ned sat in Cecil's office with the ledgers. Elizabeth had a lot of property, and a major part of Ned's job was making sure that she was paid the rents due to her in full and on time. After the midday meal, Elizabeth relaxed, and sometimes she liked her favorite servants to chat with her. They would sit in a room known as the Bishop's Parlor, which had the most comfortable chairs, a chessboard, and a virginal, on which Elizabeth would sometimes pick out tunes. Her governess, Nell Bainsford, was always there, and sometimes Tom Parry, who was her treasurer. Ned was not a member of this exclusive inner circle, but one day, when Cecil was absent, he was called in to talk about plans for Elizabeth's 25th birthday on September 7th, a couple of weeks away. Should they try to arrange a big celebration in London, which would require the permission of the Queen, or something more modest here at Hatfield, where they could do what they liked? They were deep in discussion when a surprise visitor arrived. They heard the clatter of hooves as several horses came through the arched gateway into the central courtyard. Ned went to the leaded window and peered out through the smoky glass. There were six riders, and their mounts were powerful, costly beasts. Elizabeth's grooms came out of the stables to deal with the horses. Ned looked harder at the leader of the group and was astonished to recognize him.
"It's Earl Swithin," he said. "What does he want here?"
Ned's first thought was that the visit must have something to do with the coming marriage of the Earl's son, Bart, to the girl Ned loved, Marjorie. But this was a fantasy. Even if the engagement had been broken off, the Earl would not trouble to tell Ned. What, then? The visitors were ushered into the house, taking off their dusty cloaks. A few minutes later, a servant came into the parlour to say that the Earl of Shiring would like to speak to the Lady Elizabeth, and Elizabeth ordered that he should be shown in. Earl Swithin was a big man with a loud voice, and when he entered, he filled the room with his presence. Ned, Nell, and Tom stood up, but Elizabeth remained sitting, perhaps to emphasize that her royal blood counted for more than Swithin's greater age. He made a deep bow, but spoke in familiar tones, like an uncle to a niece. "I'm pleased to see you looking so well and so beautiful," he said. "This is an unexpected delight," Elizabeth said. The compliment was fulsome, but her tone was wary. Clearly she mistrusted Swithin, and so she should, Ned thought. Loyal Catholics such as Swithin had prospered under Queen Mary Tudor, and they feared a return to Protestantism, so they did not want Elizabeth to become queen. "So beautiful, and almost 25 years old," Swithin went on. "A red-blooded man such as myself cannot help thinking that such beauty should not be wasted. You will forgive me for saying so." "Will I?" Elizabeth replied frostily. She never was amused by vague sexual innuendo uttered in tones of jollity. Swithin sensed Elizabeth's coolness and looked at the three servants standing in the background. He was clearly wondering if he might get on better without their listening. He was mildly startled when his eye fell on Ned, but he said nothing to him. Turning back to Elizabeth, he said, "May I speak privately to you, madame?" Assuming unwarranted familiarity was not the way to charm Elizabeth. She was a younger daughter, some said illegitimate, and that made her ultra-sensitive to any sign of disrespect. But Swithin was too stupid to grasp that. Tom Parry said, "The Lady Elizabeth must never be alone with a man, on the instructions of the Queen." "Nonsense," said Swithin. Ned wished that Cecil were here for this visit. It was risky for servants to stand up to an earl. The thought crossed his mind that Swithin might deliberately have arranged to come on a day when none of Elizabeth's senior staff were at the house. What was he up to? Swithin said, "Elizabeth has nothing to fear from me," and he chortled heartily. It made Ned's skin crawl. But Elizabeth took offence. "Fear," she said, raising her voice. She resented any suggestion that she was a fragile woman in need of protection. "Why should I be afraid? Of course I will speak to you privately." Reluctantly, the three servants left the room. When the door was closed, Tom said to Ned, "You know him. What is he like?" "Swithin is a violent man," Ned said. "We must stay close." He realized that Tom and Nell were looking to him for guidance. He thought fast. "Nell, will you tell the kitchen to send wine for the guest? If it became necessary to enter the room, the wine would provide a pretext." Tom said, "What will he do if we go back in?" Ned thought of Swithin's reaction to the Puritan walkout at the play. "I've seen him try to kill a man who offended him. God save us." Ned touched his head to the door. He could hear the two voices. Swithin's was loud and Elizabeth's was penetrating. He could not make out the words, but the tones were calm, if not very amiable, and he felt that for the moment Elizabeth was in no danger. Ned tried to figure out what was going on. Swithin's surprise visit must have had something to do with the succession to the throne. It was the only reason a powerful courtier would be interested in Elizabeth. Ned recalled that a much-discussed solution to the problem of the succession was to marry Elizabeth to a strong Catholic. It was assumed that she would be led by her husband in religious matters. Ned now knew Elizabeth well enough to realize that such a plan would not work, but others thought it would. King Felipe had proposed his cousin, the Duke of Savoy, but Elizabeth had refused. Did Swithin want to marry Elizabeth himself? It was possible. He might hope to seduce her on this visit. More likely, he might think that if he spent enough time alone with her, the suspicion of fornication would make a marriage the only way to rescue her reputation. He would not be the first to try. When Elizabeth had been only 14, Thomas Seymour, a man of 40,
had indulged in sexual petting with her and schemed to marry her. Seymour had ended up executed for treason, though his designs on Elizabeth had not been his only offence. Ned thought it was quite possible that the foolhardy Earl Swithin might be prepared to risk the same fate. The tones of voice within the room changed. Elizabeth began to sound commanding. Swithin went the other way, countering her coldness with a voice so amiable it was almost lecherous. If something unpleasant should happen, Elizabeth could shout for help, except that she never admitted needing help, and Swithin might be able to silence her anyway. Nell reappeared, carrying a tray with a jug of wine, two goblets and a plate of cakes. Ned held up a hand to stop her entering the room. "Not yet," he murmured. A minute later, Elizabeth made a noise that was almost a scream. It was followed by a crash and a tinkling sound that Ned guessed was a bowl of apples being knocked to the floor. He hesitated, waiting for Elizabeth to shout. But there followed a silence. Ned did not know what to do. He found the silence more sinister than anything. Unable to bear the suspense, he threw open the door, seized the tray from Nell, and stepped inside. On the far side of the room, Earl Swithin held Elizabeth in a bear hug, kissing her. Ned's worst fears had been justified. Elizabeth turned her head from side to side, trying to escape his mouth, and Ned saw her small fists beating ineffectually on Swithin's broad back. Clearly, she was unwilling, but this would be Swithin's idea of courtship, Ned thought. He would imagine that a woman might be overcome by the strength of his passion, yield to his embraces, and fall in love with him for his forceful masculinity. Elizabeth would not be won that way if Swithin were the last man on earth. In a loud voice, Ned said, "Some refreshments for you, Earl." He was shaking with fear, but he managed to make his voice jovial. "A glass of sherry wine, perhaps?" He put the tray down on a table beside the window. Swithin turned to Ned, but kept tight hold of Elizabeth's slim wrist in his deformed left hand. "Get out of here, you little tad," he said. His persistence shocked Ned. How could Swithin continue now that he had been seen? Even an earl could be executed for rape, especially if there were three independent witnesses, and both Tom and Nell were in the doorway, watching, though too terrified to enter. But Swithin was nothing, if not headstrong. Ned realized he could not leave now, no matter what. With an effort, he controlled the shaking of his hands enough to pour wine into a goblet. "And the kitchen has kindly sent some cakes. You must be hungry after your journey." Elizabeth said, "Let go of my arm, Swithin." She tugged, but even though he was holding her with his mutilated hand, the one that had lost 2½ fingers, she could not free herself. Swithin put his hand on the dagger at his belt. "Leave the room instantly, young Willard, or by God I'll slit your throat." Ned knew he was capable of it. At Newcastle, in his rages, he had injured servants in several incidents that had been smoothed over later, with a combination of threats and compensation, and if Ned defended himself, he could be hanged for wounding an earl. But he could not leave Elizabeth now. The mention of a knife inspired him. "There's been a fight in the stables," he said, extemporizing. "Two of your companions got into an argument. The grooms managed to pull them apart, but one seems badly injured. A knife wound." "Bloody liar," said Swithin, but clearly he was not sure, and the indecision cooled his ardor. Behind Ned, Nell and Tom at last came hesitantly into the room. Nell knelt down and started to pick up pieces of the broken fruit bowl. Tom cottoned on to Ned's story and said, "Your man is bleeding quite badly, Earl Swithin." Common sense began to prevail. Swithin seemed to realize he could not stab three of Elizabeth's servants without getting into trouble, and his plan of seduction had collapsed. He looked furious, but let go of Elizabeth. She immediately moved away from him, rubbing her wrist. With a grunt of frustration, Swithin strode from the room. Ned almost collapsed with relief. Nell began to cry. Tom Parry took a gulp of sherry directly from the jug. Ned said, "My lady, you should go to your private chamber with Nell
and bar the door. Tom, you and I should vanish too.
I agree, said Elizabeth,
but she did not leave immediately. She moved closer to Ned and said quietly,
There was no fight in the stables, was there?
No. It was the only thing I could think of on the spur of the moment. She smiled.
How old are you, Ned?
19.
You risked your life for me.
She stood on tiptoe and kissed him on the lips, briefly but tenderly.
Thank you,
she said. Then she left the room. Most people bathed twice a year, in spring and autumn, but princesses were fastidious, and Elizabeth bathed more often. It was a major operation, with maidservants carrying big, two-handled laundry tubs of hot water from the kitchen fire to her bedchamber, hurrying up the stairs before the water cooled. She took a bath the day after Swithin's visit, as if to wash away her disgust. She had said no more about Swithin, after kissing Ned, but Ned thought he had won her trust. Ned knew he had made an enemy of a powerful earl, but he hoped it would not last. Swithin was quick-tempered and vengeful, but, Ned thought, he had a short attention span. With luck, he would nurse his grudge against Ned only until a better one came along. Sir William Cecil had arrived shortly after Swithin left, and next morning he got down to work with Ned. Cecil's office was in the same wing as Elizabeth's private suite. He sent Ned to Tom Parry's office to fetch a ledger of expenditure for another house Elizabeth owned. Coming back with the heavy book in his hand, Ned walked along Elizabeth's corridor, where the floorboards were puddled with water spilled by the maids. As he passed her suite, he saw that the door was open and, stupidly, he glanced in. Elizabeth had just got out of her bath. The tub itself was screened off, but she had stepped across the room to pick up a large white linen sheet with which to dry herself. There should have been a maid waiting beside the tub holding the towel, and, of course, the door should have been shut. But someone had been dilatory, and Elizabeth was impatient with dozy servants. Ned had never seen a woman naked. He had no sisters. He had never gone that far with a girlfriend, and he had not visited a brothel. He froze, staring. The hot bath water, steaming faintly, ran from her dainty shoulders down her small breasts to her rounded hips and her strong thighs, muscular from riding. Her skin was creamy white, and her pubic hair was a wonderful red gold. Ned knew he should look away instantly, but he was enchanted and could not move. She caught his eye and was startled, but only for a moment. She reached out and grabbed the edge of the door. Then she smiled. A moment later, she slammed the door. Ned hurried along the corridor, his heart beating like a big drum. For what he had just done, he could be sacked from his job, put in the stocks, or flogged, or all three. But she had smiled. The smile had been warm, friendly, and a little coquettish. Ned could imagine a naked woman smiling like that at her husband or lover. The smile seemed to say that this glimpse of forbidden loveliness was a boon she was happy to grant him. He told nobody what had happened. That evening he waited for an explosion of anger, but none came. Elizabeth did not mention the incident to him or anyone else. Slowly, Ned became sure he was not going to be punished. Then he began to doubt whether it had really happened. It was more like something he might have dreamed. But he would remember that vision for the rest of his life. Marjorie was kissed by Bart for the first time in the new house, Priory Gate. Sir Reginald Fitzgerald, Lady Jane and Rollo were proudly showing Earl Swithin around. Marjorie followed with Bart, who was back from his posting to Coombe Harbour now that the threat of a French invasion seemed to have faded. Marjorie knew that Reginald had sold the rest of the priory back to the cathedral chapter as promised. The price had been low, but enough to pay for the building work on the new house to be completed. It was a grand, impressive modern structure on the market square, made of the same pale limestone as the cathedral. It had rows of large windows and tall, clustered chimneys. Inside there seemed to be staircases everywhere, and dozens of fireplaces. It smelled of new paint. Some of the chimneys smoked, and several of the doors would not close properly, but it was habitable, and servants were already moving furniture here from the old house on the high street. Marjorie did not want to live here. For her, Priory Gate would always smell of bloodshed and fraud. Filbert Cobley had been burned to death, and Alice Willard had been ruined, so that this house could be finished. Filbert and Alice had committed sins, of course, and so had to be punished. But Marjorie's sharp moral discrimination would not permit her to content herself with such blurring of distinctions. The severe sentences had been prompted by impure motives. Bishop Julius had got the priory back for the cathedral, and Marjorie's father had gained a lot of money that was not really his. A mere girl had no business thinking such thoughts, but she could not help it, and it made her angry. Bad behavior by bishops and leading Catholics was part of what drove Protestantism. Could they not see that? However, there was nothing she could do but seethe. As the party entered the long gallery, Bart lagged behind, grabbed Marjorie's elbow and pulled her back. Then, when the others were out of sight, he kissed her. Bart was tall and handsome and well-dressed, and Marjorie knew that she must love him, for he had been chosen as her husband by her parents, who had been set in authority over her by God. So she kissed him back, opening her mouth, and let him explore her body, feel her breasts, and even press his hand between her legs. It was difficult, especially as she kept remembering that Ned had kissed her in this house when it was half-built. She tried to summon the feelings that used to come over her with Ned. It did not really work, but it made the ordeal a little easier to bear. She broke the embrace and saw Swithin watching them.
"We were wondering where you two had got to," he said.
Then he gave a conspiratorial grin and a lascivious wink. Marjorie found it creepy that he had stood there watching until she had noticed him. The party sat down in the room designated as Sir Reginald's parlour to talk about the wedding. It was just a month away. Marjorie and Bart would be married in Kingsbridge Cathedral, and there would be a banquet here in the new house. Marjorie had ordered a dress in pale blue silk and an elaborate headdress in the jaunty style she loved. Earl Swithin wanted to know all the details of her outfit, almost as if he would be marrying her himself. Her parents had to have new clothes, too, and there were 100 other decisions to be made. There would be entertainment as well as food and drink for the guests, and Sir Reginald would have to provide free beer for all comers at the gate. They were discussing what play would be appropriate to finish the festivities when the head groom, Percy, came in, followed by a young man with the dust of the road on his clothes.
"A courier from London, Sir Reginald," said Percy. "He assures me you would not want to delay hearing his news."
Sir Reginald looked at the courier.
"What is it?" "I bring a letter from Davy Miller, sir."
Miller was Reginald's business representative in London. The courier held out a slim leather wallet.
"Tell me what it says, man," said Sir Reginald impatiently.
"The Queen is ill."
"What's wrong with her?"
"The doctors say there is a malignant growth in her female parts that is causing her belly to swell."
Rollo said, "Ah, those false pregnancies.
It is so bad that she sometimes falls unconscious." "The poor Queen," said Marjorie. She had mixed feelings about Mary Tudor.
The Queen was an admirably strong-willed and devout woman, but the burnings of Protestants were wrong. Why could people not be devout and merciful at the same time, like Jesus? Rollo said worriedly, "What's the prognosis?"
"We understand that she may take some months to die, but she will not recover."
Marjorie saw Rollo turn a little pale, and a moment later she understood why.
"This is the worst possible news,"
he said. "Mary Tudor has no child, and young Mary Stuart has made herself a less attractive successor by marrying the wretched French boy. That makes Elizabeth Tudor the leading candidate, and all our efforts to bring her under control have failed." Rollo was right. Marjorie had not seen it as quickly as he had, but as soon as he said it, she understood, and so did her father and the Earl. England was in danger of falling back into the swamp of heresy. She shivered. Swithin said,
"Elizabeth must not become queen. That would be a catastrophe."
Marjorie looked at Bart, but he seemed bored. Her husband-to-be was impatient with politics.
He preferred to talk about horses and dogs. She felt annoyed with him. The topic was their future. Reginald said, "Mary Stuart is married to a French prince, and the English people don't want another foreign king."
"The English people will have no say in the matter," Swithin grunted. "Tell them now that their next monarch will be Mary Stuart. By the time it happens, they will have got used to the idea."
Marjorie thought that was wishful thinking, and her father showed, by his next remark, that he agreed.
"We can tell them anything," said Reginald. "But will they believe us?"
Rollo answered the question.
"They might,"
he said with a speculative air. He was thinking on his feet, Marjorie could tell, but what he was saying made sense, especially if the announcement was endorsed by King Felipe.
"Perhaps," said Sir Reginald. "First, we would have to get King Felipe to agree."
Marjorie began to see a glimmer of hope. Rollo said, "Then we will go and see King Felipe." "Where is he now?" "In Brussels, leading his army against the French. But that war is almost over. We may have to be quick if the Queen is as ill as she seems."
"Indeed. We can get passage from Combe Harbour to Antwerp. Dan Cobley has ships going every week. From Antwerp to Brussels is a day's ride. We'll be back for the wedding."
It was ironic, Marjorie thought, that they would have to rely on the ultra-Protestant Dan Cobley to transport them on this mission.
Rollo said, "Would King Felipe receive us?"
Swithin answered that.
"He would receive me. England is one of his kingdoms, and I'm one of its greatest noblemen, and he stayed at Newcastle once after the marriage, on his way from Winchester to London."
The three men looked at one another, Reginald, Rollo, and Swithin.
"Very well," said Reginald. "We'll go to Brussels."
Marjorie felt better. At least they were doing something. Rollo stood up.
"I'll go and see Dan about a ship," he said. "We can't afford to lose any time."
Ned Willard did not want to go to Kingsbridge for Marjorie's wedding, but he had to. The ceremony provided too good a pretext for his undercover mission. In October, he retraced the steps of his July journey, but this time on horseback. His mission was urgent. The Queen was dying, and everything was urgent. His mother seemed shrunken. It was not so much physical. She was still quite heavy, but the spirit had gone out of her. Ned had not really believed her back in June when she had said,
"I'll be 50 soon. I haven't got the energy."
But 3 months later she was still despondent and lethargic. Ned felt sure now that Alice would never revive the family enterprise. It made him grind his teeth with rage. But things were going to change. Ned was part of the force that would break the power of men such as Bishop Julius and Sir Reginald. Ned was thrilled to be part of Elizabeth's household. Both Cecil and Elizabeth liked him, especially since he had defied Swithin. He felt a surge of eager anticipation every time he thought about how they would change the world together. But first, they had to put Elizabeth on the throne of England. He stood with his mother in the market square, waiting for the bride. A brisk north wind blew across the open space. As always, the couple would exchange vows in the porch of the church, then go inside for the wedding mass. Kingsbridge people greeted Ned warmly. Most of them felt that his family had been severely mistreated. Swithin and Bart stood at the front of the crowd, Bart wearing a new yellow doublet. There was no sign of the bride yet. Would she look happy or sad? Was she heartbroken, her life ruined because she was not marrying Ned? Or was she by now getting over her love for him and beginning to enjoy her new role with Viscount Bart? Ned was not sure which he would find harder to bear. But he was not really here for Marjorie. He raked the crowd, looking for the Protestants. He spotted Dan Cobley and began his mission. Faking a casual air, he strolled across the square to speak to Dan, who was standing outside the northwest corner of the cathedral. Dan seemed changed, although it had been only 3 months. He had lost some weight, and his face looked harder as well as leaner. Ned was pleased by the change, for his mission was to turn Dan into a military leader. It would not be easy. Exchanging pleasantries, he drew Dan behind a mighty buttress, then spoke in a low voice.
"The Queen is fighting for her life."
"So I hear,"
said Dan warily. Ned was disheartened to see that Dan did not trust him, but he understood why. The Willards had switched from Catholicism to Protestantism and back again too easily for Dan's liking. Now Dan was not sure where they really stood. Ned said, "The succession is a contest between Elizabeth Tudor and Mary Stuart. Now Mary is 15 years old, and married to a sickly husband who is even younger. She would be a weak queen, dominated by her French uncles, the Guises, who are ultra-Catholic. You need to fear her.
But Elizabeth goes to Mass.
And she may continue to do so after she becomes queen. No one really knows." This was not true. Ned and everyone close to Elizabeth knew she would become openly Protestant as soon as she could, for that was the only way to break the stranglehold of the Church. But they were pretending otherwise to disarm the opposition. In the world of kings and courtiers, Ned had learned, no one told all of the truth all of the time. Dan said, "In that case, why should I care whether our next monarch is Elizabeth Tudor or Mary Stuart? If Elizabeth becomes queen, she will not burn Protestants for their beliefs." That part was true. Fury blazed in Dan's eyes at this reminder of his father's dreadful death, but he controlled his emotions.
"That's easy to say.
Be realistic. You want the slaughter of Protestants to stop. Elizabeth is not just your best hope. She's your only hope." Dan did not want to believe this, Ned guessed, but he saw in Dan's eyes an acknowledgement of the truth, and had the satisfaction of feeling one step closer to his goal. Reluctantly, Dan said,
"Why are you telling me this?"
Ned answered Dan's question with a question. "How many Protestants are there in Kingsbridge now?" Dan looked stubborn and said nothing.
"You have to trust me," Ned said urgently. "Come on."
"At least 2,000, Dan said at last.
"What?"
Ned was pleasantly surprised.
"I imagined a few hundred at most.
There's more than one group, and the numbers have increased since June. Because of what happened to your father?" Dan looked bitter.
"More because of what happened to your mother. They're scared to do business. No deal is safe now. Most of these people don't care about a Protestant martyr, but they can't live with a church that steals their money."
Ned nodded. He suspected Dan was right. Few people became passionate about doctrinal disputes, but everyone had to make a living, and a church that stopped them doing that was bound to run into trouble. Ned said, "I've come here from Hatfield with one question for you, Dan, and I could be in danger just for asking it. So please think before you answer." Dan looked scared.
"Don't involve me in anything treasonable."
That was exactly what Ned was about to do. He said, "Out of those 2,000 Protestants, how many able-bodied men could you muster, when the Queen dies, to fight for Elizabeth against the supporters of Mary Stuart?" Dan looked away.
"I have no idea."
He was prevaricating, Ned knew. He moved closer to Dan, pressing the point. "What if a group of Catholic noblemen, led perhaps by Earl Swithin, were to muster an army to march on Hatfield, intending to take Elizabeth prisoner while they wait for Mary Stuart and her hardline uncles to arrive from France? Would you stand by and let that happen?
400 Kingsbridge men won't make any difference."
So it was 400, Ned thought. That was the information he needed. He was pleased. It was more than he had expected. He said, "Do you imagine you're the only brave Protestants in England?" He lowered his voice more. "Every city in the land has a group like yours, ready to march to Hatfield and defend Elizabeth, waiting only for the word from her." For the first time, Dan's face was lit by hope, albeit hope of revenge.
"Is that true?" he said.
It was something of an exaggeration, but not entirely untrue. Ned said, "If you want the freedom to worship in the way you so passionately believe is right, and to do so without the fear every minute that you might be burned alive for it, then you must be ready to fight. And I mean fight with swords." Dan nodded thoughtfully. "And there's one other thing you have to do," Ned went on. "Watch what Earl Swithin and Sir Reginald are up to. Send a fast messenger to me at Hatfield as soon as they do anything unusual, such as stockpiling weapons.
Early information is the key.
Dan said nothing. Ned stared at him, waiting for a reply, hoping for assent. At last, Dan said,
I'll think about what you've said.
Then he walked away. Ned was frustrated. He had felt confident that Dan would be eager to revenge the killing of his father by leading a Kingsbridge militia to fight for Elizabeth, and he had assured Sir William Cecil of it. Perhaps he had been overconfident. Discouraged, Ned made his way back across the square, heading for where his mother stood. Halfway there, he found himself facing Rollo Fitzgerald, who said, What's news of the Queen? It was on everyone's minds, of course. Ned said, She is gravely ill.
There are rumours that Elizabeth intends to permit Protestantism if she becomes Queen.
Rollo made it sound like an accusation.
Rumours, indeed?
Ned had no intention of getting into that kind of discussion. He moved to step around Rollo, but Rollo blocked his way.
Or even that she wants to turn England to heresy, as her father did.
Rollo lifted his chin aggressively.
Is it true?
Who told you that?
Consider this, said Rollo, who could ignore a question as effortlessly as Ned. If she tries it, who will oppose her?
Rome, of course. Indeed, said Ned. The Pope's policy on Protestants is extermination. Rollo put his hands on his hips and leaned forward belligerently. The stance was familiar to Ned from their school days. This was Rollo playing the bully. She will also be opposed by the King of Spain, who is the richest and most powerful man in the world. Perhaps. The position of Spain was not that simple, but there was certainly some danger that King Felipe would try to undermine Elizabeth. And the King of France, probably the second most powerful. That, too, was a real danger. Not to mention the King of Portugal and the Queen of Scots. Ned was pretending to be indifferent to this argument, but Rollo was dismayingly right. Almost all Europe was going to turn on Elizabeth if she did what Ned knew perfectly well she intended to do. He had known all this, but Rollo's summation was hammering the points home with chilling effect. Rollo went on, and who would support her? The King of Sweden and the Queen of Navarre. Navarre was a small kingdom between Spain and France. You paint a dramatic picture. Rollo came uncomfortably close. He was tall and loomed threateningly over Ned. She would be very foolish indeed to quarrel with so many powerful men. Ned said, Take a step back, Rollo. If you don't, I promise you I will pick you up with both hands and throw you. Rollo looked uncertain. Ned put a hand on Rollo's shoulder, in a gesture that might have been friendly, and said, I won't tell you twice. Rollo pushed Ned's hand off his shoulder, but then he turned away. That's how Elizabeth and I deal with bullies, said Ned. There was a fanfare of trumpets, and the bride appeared. Ned caught his breath. She looked wonderful. Her dress was a pale sky blue with a dark blue underskirt. It had a high collar that stood up dramatically behind, like a fan, framing her curly hair. Her jeweled headdress had a plume at an angle. Ned heard a group of girls nearby murmur approval. Glancing at their faces, he saw mainly envy. It occurred to him that Marjorie had hooked the man they all wanted. Bart was the most eligible bachelor in the county. They thought she had won first prize. How wrong they were. Sir Reginald walked beside her, looking proud in a doublet of gorgeous red silk embroidered with gold thread, and Ned thought, angrily, He paid for all this with my mother's money. Ned studied Marjorie's expression as she came across the square, looking tiny and helpless as she approached the massive stones of the west front. What was she thinking? Her lips were set in a half smile, and she looked from side to side, nodding at friends. She seemed confident and proud, but Ned knew her better. Serenity was not her mode. The natural Marjorie was playful, mischievous, amused, and amusing. There was no laughter in her today. She was putting on an act, like the boy impersonating Mary Magdalene in the play. As she passed where he stood, she caught his eye. She had not known he would be here, and she was shocked. Her eyes widened in dismay. She looked away from him immediately, but she had lost her self-possession. Her fixed smile faltered, and a moment later she stumbled. Ned stepped forward automatically to help her, but he was 5 yards away. Sir Reginald, next to her, caught her arm, but his reaction was late and his arm was not strong enough to save her. She lost her balance and went down on her knees. The crowd gasped. It was bad luck. A fall on the way to your wedding was the worst possible omen for your married life. Marjorie remained on her knees for a few seconds, catching her breath and trying to regain her composure while her family clustered around her. Ned was one of many people trying to look over their shoulders to see if she was all right. Those farther away in the crowd were asking each other what had happened. Then Marjorie stood upright again and seemed steady enough on her feet. Her face assumed the same controlled expression. She looked around, smiling ruefully as if at her own clumsiness.